Architecture forgot to build one critical thing, its own support system. That operational chaos you feel every day, it's why your best people burn out. Why project fees get eaten up from design conflicts being discovered during construction. You have projects not making any profit, and why you're still working after your family is asleep. That's the daily chaos most architecture firms face because practical training is missing from the start. Hi, I'm Caitlin Rosier, an architect on a mission to fix this. The Mentor Dino Academy is your firm's secret weapon for giving you your time back and boosting your bottom line. It's the training system that bridges the knowledge gap, helping your teams master the skills they need to work smarter, reduce costly mistakes, and build a more profitable firm. Stop the chaos. Visit MentorDino.com to learn more. The Academy is the tool to fix the chaos, and this podcast is where we share stories and perspectives that inspire a better way forward.
Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dino podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Rosier. I am an architect and founder of Mentor Dino. Join me each week as I speak with amazing professionals in and around the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, as we are all part of a larger interconnected community. We discuss everything from career stories, lessons learned, and advice for others finding their own unique career path. Thank you to all of our current subscribers, and if you're new, welcome to the conversation. And if you like this episode, please do me a favor by hitting subscribe, like, or share it with a friend. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support them on their own unique career journey.
Welcome back to the Mentor Dino podcast, and this is the final part of our firm series. So this is episode 4 of our firm series. We had episode 1 was for solo firm owners. Episode 2 was firm owners that started as a partnership. And episode 3 was the small, medium-sized firms that start to have their own team. And that is a mix of professionals that are still younger in their firm starting out and having a team, and then even professionals that have been around for 10 years plus. So this episode, we're diving into large firms. And so I don't have as many large firm owners. It is a little bit interesting to dive into large firms because there aren't many large firm owners that actually started the firm. They are more taking on that role and shifting into that position. What large firms do, though, it lends itself to having different areas of leadership. And that's where I'm going to focus this episode. You don't have to be a firm owner to be a principal in a large firm. And principal in a large firm is very different than a principal, solo entrepreneur, or small firm owner. So a principal in a smaller firm is really going to have to start to deal with more of the administration, making sure invoices and billing is going out, plus doing proposals they may still be drafting. It all depends on their size. Once you get to a large firm, you can be a principal and have a different type of career from that standpoint. You may end up being a CEO or C-suite professional in a large firm, but you may be a discipline lead or a studio director type scenario. So if you have different specialties and you really want to focus in on a special type of construction or project type, not saying you can't be a discipline lead in a smaller firm or have a specialty, but usually at a smaller firm level, you are the main person. And if it's your specialty, that's what the whole firm does. Whereas the larger firms, you have a lot of different paths and angles. So this time I am sticking with architects for this one. I did have professionals on the podcast that are engineers within large firms. So this one, it was hard to pick, and their stories are pretty interesting that I want to give them a little bit longer clips. So I stuck with just 3 professionals for this one. So I'm going to introduce you to Ty Osbo. He is at Gensler. He was episode number 9, and he focuses on airports and actually was doing the Pittsburgh airport at the time of the podcast recording. Steve Lodge at Smith Group. He is a architecture discipline lead out of the Detroit office, and he was episode number 49. And finally, introduce you to Carol Ricard Bordeaux. She is now CEO of Little, And she was episode number 73. So for her story, she's going to be explaining how moving up within a firm and taking on that role. We talk a lot about firm transitions. So if you're going through a firm transition right now, you can always check out her whole episode. But how she stepped into that leadership role and how that transition occurred. So, but let's start out with Ty. So Ty Osbo, again, is episode number 9, and he is with Gensler and focuses on airports. So we talk about when you specialize in airports, your team tends to move where the project is. They are larger scale projects. They take several years. So he's lived in different areas. So if traveling is something that you're really interested in, you don't want to feel like you're stuck in any one city and you can't move around, maybe airports and aviation design could be something you're interested in. So he's spent his whole career at Gensler. So we also talk about that and growing within that firm and what's it like being in a larger firm. So for his episode, it's really going to be about how you specialize and how you can take that specialty and become an expert in it and what that means, how you mentor, how you run projects, and what it looks like at a large firm scale. So hope you guys enjoy this episode with Ty. And I know you mentioned you've been at Gensler your entire career, which is more abnormal. Do you have any advice for people that may be in a similar situation where they absolutely love the firm they're in, but people are telling them to move on? How would you give them advice to move up in your career when staying within one firm?
I can speak to my perception of Gensler. I know that it's not a one size fits all, and it's not a playbook that's out there. For Gensler, and I'd mentioned earlier about how moving from city to city was one of the benefits of being in aviation. And I truly believe that that's one of the things that kept me at Gensler and has kept me at Gensler for so long, because I never got stale in an environment. Every couple years, it was always an opportunity to try something new. I think depending on the size of your firm, it's always looking for what are things that challenge you. I hate when people say something about do something that you're passionate about. Like, I don't believe that at all. I think you do things that you're good at, and then your passion follows that. Because if we only did what we're passionate about, we wouldn't necessarily be working. We would be doing something completely different. So I think it's just a matter of making sure that you find things that challenge you and reward you, whatever that might be.
Yeah, because if you're not challenged, you can get burnt out in a different direction where mm-hmm. you're just neglect at that point, and you don't have that motivation to go in and expand yourself. So I definitely agree with you there to make sure you're always challenged.
Yeah.
Switching over into the aviation side, what are some of the challenges associated with aviation work?
By far, the biggest challenge that I see, I'll tell you what it's not. Everyone has when I tell people that I design airport terminals, everyone says, oh, you must be very technically inclined. There are so many regulations. There are regulations, but it's nothing that every other building typology doesn't have. So that can quickly be easily be overcome. Hardest part to me is the amount of stakeholders and the decision-making process. These are massive, massive projects that a lot of times our clients they don't build big buildings like this all the time. Most cities will build a massive terminal once every 40 years. So their skill sets and their ability to understand the design process are fairly limited. So we have to always keep reminding ourselves that our clients are novice. So we have to walk them through the process and really help them make decisions so that they can tell us what they want to do. It's not like doing an office building for a developer who's done 1,000 buildings and they've got a very strict process. I'm going to go from A to B to C. Sometimes in aviation, you're going from A to Z, then coming back to P somewhere in the middle, and then you go backwards to go forward again. So it's just getting used to that fluidity of the decision-making process is really something that just takes a long time to get comfortable with.
Yeah. And then what What are your users you're speaking to? Are you bringing in pilots, or is it just the city who owns the airport? Like, what are the groups you're talking to?
So it usually starts with the owner of the airport. I'll use Pittsburgh as the example. That in Pittsburgh, the owner is the ACAA, Allegheny County Aviation Authority. They are, think of them as kind of a landlord, so that all the airlines then are tenants that pay the airport rent for using space within their facility. And it's the airport's responsibility to provide them with gates, with hold rooms, and all the amenities that go with it. So yeah, at the end of the day, our client is the airport, ACAA, but they are beholden to make sure that their tenants are happy. So all the airlines will assign a representative who kind of comes into a group of the airlines, will band together, and they'll have one voice. So that one voice then speaks for all the different airlines. So you have them as one user. The TSA, who controls all the security, is a user. The CBP, if you're going to do immigration. And then there's all the ACA staff who will ultimately maintain the building. So the electricians, that it's just a whole series of different users that go into it. So you kind of get all the feedback of all those groups that bubbles up. You then kind of distill it all down. I think of it as kind of pieces of the puzzle. Then you put the pieces of that puzzle together and see what design comes out in the end. Then you do it. You present a design. They yell and scream at you saying you didn't listen to us. You take it on the chin. You go back, you do it again, and just keep going over and over again. And eventually you're honing in on what is a really solid design.
Yeah. And you mentioned the TSA and being around during the 9/11 change. How did that event change how aviation design is done? Did you guys have to pivot right after 9/11 to readjust things? How did that go?
Well, actually, before 9/11, there wasn't a TSA. TSA was a reaction to 9/11. So prior to that, you could go anywhere. Anybody could go anywhere in the airport, guests with or without tickets. So when we were in Chicago during 9/11, we were one of the only airport projects that was in design at that point. So we were working with TSA to kind of write the manual on what they were going to be. And for those of us who are old enough to remember, one of the first reactions the TSA had was to put a whole series of those screening devices that were about as big as a minivan in the check-in hall of every terminal, and kind of gummed it up, and passengers had to move around them. So that was kind of the first idea about the way that screening systems would work. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, but it was kind of trial and error, figuring out what worked, what didn't work. But we were all learning.
Yeah, because I've seen it a lot in terms of its growth and change over the years. But when 9/11 hit, I was like fifth grade or something. So it was like, nope, you're not going anywhere. We didn't travel for a while. So it's like, and then by the time you remember the different things, I remember being able to walk through the airport and get, because for Pittsburgh, if anybody's not traveled through Pittsburgh, it's a land side and an air side, and there's a tram that connects. So before, you could just walk straight in. I don't remember the not having TSA makes sense, but I just remember being able to go through and wait for loved ones or take siblings to the plane and be able to do that. What's your favorite aviation project you've worked on?
I really have enjoyed working on Pittsburgh, but that's pandering to the crowd. I've been involved for the past year, well, actually 2 years now, on a project at JFK for New Terminal 1. I really enjoyed it. We won it as a design competition. There's, you know, when you work abroad, a lot of the methodology of how you win work in Asia and in Europe is design competition. Very rarely does that happen in the U.S. In the U.S., it's mostly based on quals and just based on different relationships that you have. But JFK, New Terminal 1, they did a design competition. We did a very progressive design, not necessarily in the form or anything, but the restacking of the building where we took, for anyone who's traveled a lot internationally, you know, the typical process is you come off of the aircraft and then you go down into the basement, and that's where you go through immigration. We took a very different tact and said, well, why wouldn't you elevate that arrivals experience, especially coming into New York, the gateway into the U.S. for a lot of people coming here for the first time? Why wouldn't you take that immigration hall and pull it out of the bowels of the building, light down in it, and you make an arrival experience, which when you think of most airport terminals are designed for that one glamour shot of the big soaring room as you're leaving the city. But why not try to think about it in reverse of let's make a moment for the people arriving into New York and into the U.S. and really elevate that. So that's the one that's fresh in my mind. And it's really kind of exciting to see how that's going to turn out.
Now I want to introduce you to Steve Lodge. He is at Smith Group and is an architecture discipline lead out of Detroit. So for them, they have different discipline leads based on the actual office location for larger offices. And then you have your overall discipline lead for the entire Smith Group. So Steve Lodge focuses in on Detroit and also helps out our Pittsburgh office. So learning about his career, and he actually started out his career in a smaller firm and then transitioned and grew into a large firm. And he talks about how sometimes just being in the right place at the right time can lead you to opportunities, and just letting people know your strengths, where your passion is. And sometimes a role comes up at the right time and it aligns with your skill set. And when a firm can recognize that and help you step into roles that you won't even imagine. So this is Steve Lodge's clip, and he was episode number 49. If you want to hear more about his full story.
I got in and I, you know, did the classes, and I would say that I did my thesis, and I'm really thankful that I did it the way that I did, because, it should have been like a 2-year program, but I think I crammed it into 4. The thesis I didn't take my thesis last because I knew that I wanted to really, do what I could to focus on that. And then there was a masterclass, I think they called it, was the last one, and it was kind of taken over the summer after you finished your thesis. And so, and I remember while I was doing my thesis full year long class, there was a student that it was his last class. That was it. Once he was done with that, he was done and out. And about halfway through the second semester, like he tanked, like he just tapped out, like he couldn't do it anymore. He just lost his drive. And I was afraid that was going to happen to me because school was never easy for me. The academic part was, you know, always more challenging. I think I took calculus three times before I passed it with a D. Yes. You know, I got out of that one. I knew that. Yes, right. That's what I said. I knew that I had to have the endurance to run it, you know, all the way through. And I really focused on it. And I really give credit to Art Smith, my professor of my thesis class, because halfway through, after the first semester, another good story there, a side note, we can talk about that later. Which will relate to some Smith Group work. You know, I didn't get a very good critique from the critics that were, you know, the crit that I had at the end of the first semester was pretty, a big downer. In fact, they didn't think that what I was doing was the right direction to go in at all. And it was Art Smith who told me after that my presentation, and they criticized me pretty heavily for what I was doing. He said, well, you know, do you think what you're doing is right? You know, do you think it's the right thing? And I said, yeah, I do. He said, okay, so just prove them wrong. Just prove that they're wrong. It's that simple. It's KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. Stick to your concept. Mm-hmm. Stick to your guns and prove them wrong. Can you do that? He asked me that question. And I said, yeah, I guess so. No, can you do that? And I said, yes, I can do that. He said, okay, it's that simple. Go do it. And so I stuck to my guns. You know, I think I had like a D or a C or something like that after the first semester from those professors. So not from my professor, but from the jury that, you know, critiqued. At the end of my thesis, had turned into an A. And all but one agreed that the project direction that I had taken and continued to stay on track with was the right direction. The one who disagreed with that was Paul Urbanek. Paul Urbanek, the design director for Smith Group. Little did I know at the time that I would end up working with Paul Urbanek.
I'm glad. I hope any Smith Group listeners got it the second I started laughing. So,
Yeah. Anyway, but
nobody ever says that in studio. Like, it's always tear your project apart, flip it over, and make you squirm. I wish I had a professor at any one point that I had a really bad crit saying, like, how can you prove them wrong? Like, what is changing how you present, either showing or verbally, to show the idea differently if you feel that that's the right path to go? And so I think that's brilliant by that studio professor to kind of like push you in that right direction.
I agree. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I knew what I had to do. And then I knew that he would be there to remind me of that every step of the way, that if I was going to go off and try something, you know, well, I did this because I thought it would look cool. Nope. That's a tie to your concept. If it doesn't, don't do it. Keep it simple. Stick to your concept. Go back to your concept. If it doesn't support your concept, don't do it. And so I just kept telling myself, you know, that all the way through. Mm-hmm. It was grueling. It was brutal. I mean, I would. So I'm working at French during this time. And I had classes, you know, that started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a 45 minute drive down to school. I'd be working from 8 until 3. I'd leave work, drive down to school for a 3 hour, you know, design class, come back at 7 or something. Pick up dinner on the way, go back to work because I had to work full time. I mean, I had to remain full time employed. So mm-hmm. I was working full time and going to school, which doesn't sound like a lot. You know, like to now, a lot of people are doing that right now. We've got employees right now that are getting their master's degree online in the evenings. But this was driving and doing the work in studio for a 3 hour block or whatever. And it was, you know, two classes or something. So, not to mention having, you know, a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old and, you know, cutting the grass and, you know, doing family things, remodeling a house, whatever I was doing, you know, all of that was all on top of it. I don't know how I did it. I really don't. When I look back on it now, it's not a path I would recommend, but it is the path I took and it's the path I chose. Had I known how it was going to go, would I have done it differently? Maybe. Am I thankful that I did it the way that I did? Yeah, I think I learned a lot about, you know, this craft and the way that it can be done. And I think the description of me that I've liked the best, that somebody told me, I'm very passionate about what I do. I get excited talking about the path that I've been on because it's just filled with passion to me. Like, there's no other way to explain, you know, why I've done what I've done. I think about this often, that there's people probably more qualified to be in the role that I'm in right now at Smith Group. And I thought that when I was asked to be in this role, I wasn't sure why they thought, but they obviously saw something in me that they wanted me to be in this role. And so I accepted it. And I have done it passionately ever since. I said I would from the time that I started, that I will, you know, work my hardest to do the best that I can. And I think I've done that. I have been passionate about it. That passion has changed focus a little bit, you know, during the time that I've been here. I am passionate about architecture and passionate about the things that I believe in. So I think that helps to drive me, because architects are a little quirky anyway, right? Like we really get really connected to the projects that we're involved in. And I'm no exception to that. You know, I feel a little bit of me has gone into every project that I worked on, because it's the project and, you know, the what it's doing and who I'm doing it for that drives me. It's not the dollar. It's not the people I work for or the people I work with. It's what I'm trying to accomplish or what is I've been tasked with trying to accomplish for the client. And that's what has driven me, I think, you know, on the projects that I've worked on and why I've worked the hours that I have and how hard I have it is because of this idea of, you know, well, they have this thing I'm trying to solve. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I've been tasked to do. And so I want to do it to the best of my ability. You know, I remember my dad telling me when I was working at Sudan, sweeping floors, working in a warehouse. Thankfully, I never worked on it was a stamping plant. I never worked on the stamping plants that have all my fingers. That, you know, if you're sweeping a floor and that's your job, then sweep it to the best of your ability. You know, if you're making boxes, that's what I would make was boxes and drive a high-low, then do the best you can at it. You know, we need all people working in all areas and doing the best that they can. And so to be a professional at what they do, whatever that is, it's not a disgrace to work in a labor intensive job, but do it to the best of your ability. Don't be lazy. There's an expectation that you're going to do something because that's what you're getting paid to do. So do it to the best that you can. Don't do it halfway. And so I think that's how I've, you know, try to lead my work ethic all my years of working.
Yeah, that's great advice. And for anybody at any level, any position, no matter what you're doing.
I know
when people start to transition into that principal or even the director position, you start to pull away from project work and doing a little bit more office admin or staff, because the director of architecture for your position is a little bit more staff based, is more what I've seen. So how was that transition for you moving to that position? And do I even have the role correctly?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I think that's one thing that so Smith Group had when I started at Smith Group, I came as a project architect. I, you know, like I said, I left French because I didn't I didn't say this, but I didn't know if they were going to make it through. We had dwindled down quite a bit. And even though I liked the work that I was doing, we, you know, kept losing people. And so either through layoffs or through their own, you know, just lack of work. And so I was in my late 40s, I guess, looking at 50, and I had kind of predetermined for whatever reason that I really didn't want to be the last one out the door of this building that I had, you know, worked on and enslaved over. We had changed locations in the building. It had been kind of relegated to not the fireplace space that I described earlier. Was getting a little, I was working hard. I had taken a pay cut. You know, there was some loss of benefits and things like that. And so it was all had to be done. And I was treated well. I wasn't, you know, poorly treated or anything, but I was just getting a little bitter, I think. I was working really hard. One of my consulting engineers, as I was working late one evening, and so as he said something to me about, well, you're an owner in the firm. I mean, that's why you're working so hard. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not an owner of this firm. I'm just an employee. And it like made me wonder, wait a second, why am I working this hard? Putting in 60 hour weeks and 70 hour weeks. I was in line for ownership. That was part of the plan that I was going to transition to ownership. I anticipated that I would retire from French Associates. And but because of 2008 and just, you know, the economy and all of that, that plan just, you know, went to pot. So it was after that kind of realization. I don't know that it was a good thing. But it was then that I said, I think I might need to find a different job. But I've been doing this for 18 years, K-12. I don't want to go to another K-12 firm because the other firms in the area, I competed against them. I couldn't go to the competition ethically. That just bothered me. So not that it's wrong. It just wasn't right for me. And so Tricia Beck, I had worked with at French Associates for a number of years. We were really good friends there. And she had left a year or so before me and went to Smith Group. And we stayed in contact. She contacted me one day and said, hey, guess who just came for an interview here? It was another coworker that we had that had worked with us at French. And I said, you're kidding me. How did he get an interview? She said, well, you know somebody that works here. I said, well, when's my interview? And she said, do you want to leave French? And I'm like, maybe, but they don't do K-12 work, so they're not going to hire me. She said, you know how to put a building together. They'll hire you. Okay, so I put my resume together and sent it down there. She took it to who it needed to be gone to. I think I had 3 or 4 people in interviews with me. Apparently, they liked something they saw, and they made me an offer, and so I started there. I started out working on a higher ed project for Western Michigan University. It was a dining hall project, and I was the lead project PA that was already started in SD. On week one, they said, hey, Steve, welcome aboard. Here's the project. You're a week behind, or whatever. It was already behind schedule. And so introduced me to the team. We started working on it. We were furiously working away at it. It was going to be a really great project, a dining facility, and great people were already on the team, and I was trying to figure out how we put buildings together and how we did our drawings. And I knew Revit a little bit, but I was really good at CAD, but this project was in Revit, and that freaked me out a little bit. You know, how am I going to do that? I had learned Revit at French, but we never really used it there to its full capacity. So I'm trying to learn Revit and be the PA and, you know, figure out how things go together. And we get into close to end of CDs, mid CDs, and the university got a lot of grief because we were going to be cutting down a bunch of trees in a sustainable way and reusing the wood in the project, as well as planting new trees. But some students and activists on campus got pretty heated up over this, and students were chaining themselves to trees so we wouldn't cut them down. And so the project ultimately got canceled.
Welcome back. And the final clip I want to introduce you to is Carol Ricard Berdeau. She was episode number 73, and she is the CEO at Little. So she talks about growing within Little, her experiences, where her passions are, and what it was like when all of a sudden the leader and CEO of the firm was talking to her about filling in his shoes so he could retire, and what that growth looks like. She even talks in her episode about a transition plan, and if you have any overlap, her recommended time frame, because it can definitely be hard for somebody who's been running a firm to let go. You get in a tendency of just running the firm and doing things your way. And sometimes when you pass the torch, you just have to let that professional do it their way. You can be there to mentor, and it is so important to have that mentorship as you're stepping into a different role in a different leadership responsibility, but what that transition was like. And so if you're going through a firm transition or thinking about in the future or wanting to buy into and owning a firm in that way, definitely check out Carol's episode, and you can always reach out to her personally. So again, Carol's episode is number 73, and I hope you guys enjoy this little clip. And I wanted to also dive into, I know you said you jumped around to small firms when you first started your career, yeah. And Little is a large firm.
Yeah.
So how do you bring that aspect of, you know, your training, your own training was in a small firm. How do you bring those aspects to you running a large firm? Because it's very different.
It is very different. And it's very interesting because it's also kind of evolved. The person who founded Little was Bill Little, go figure. And he was an amazing guy, just a huge bolt of energy, massive, great heart, very much of an abundance mentality. It was amazing. And he organized the firm like it was a bunch of small firms. So each studio was probably no more than 10 people, so that the studio principal would, as the phrase that we used to talk about internally is, you know, feel the heat from the client. So the people within their studio are hearing it directly from the client. There's not like a third party interlocutor who's, you know, interpreting what the client said. But it was very much about each studio principal being an entrepreneur and having like their own firm under the umbrella of a large firm with the resource of a large firm. So in that respect, it wasn't too different. Excuse me. And it was also for me, I did have a fear of larger firms, to be honest. And when I first came to Little, I want to say we were maybe about 150, 160 people. We were about 450 or 60 now. And so I was a little concerned, honestly, because I had friends who had gone to large firms and they were, you know, I say stuck, but they were learning, obviously, but they were doing door details or, you know, jam details all day, every day for months, you know, and then they'd be like, oh my God, I can't take it anymore. So I was very wary of it. But I think my husband and I both found out very quickly that it was not the way, it was not the case at Little. And what made the difference for us was the culture. So I think there are benefits, there are pros and cons to large firms and small firms. What I liked about being in a small firm was that I was given way too much responsibility at a very early age. And that was great, you know, great for me, maybe not great for my boss. Because I made mistakes, you know, and you learn through pain, as my mother-in-law used to say. So I was able to make mistakes. I was able to have lessons that I learned and took to heart and I remembered because they were painful. But there's a lot to be said for large firms. You know, I think it depends on the person. It depends on what you're looking for, I think. You know, what are you looking for? Are you looking for the ability to work on, you know, world-class projects? You can get that in large firms and small firms. You might go to a small boutique firm that's very narrowly focused, but it's definitely a possibility. So I would say, looking back, you know, the ideas that I had about a large firm being a certain kind of way were not true.
Yeah, because no matter what size firm, I always like telling people firms are as unique as individuals.
Very much so.
You may love a large firm in one spot, but hate it in another, or even city to city, or small firms could be the same thing. Yeah. Like really finding that spot where the people, I think, really make it or break it, depending on if that fit works for them.
Totally agree. Yeah, completely agree.
And I know you're coming up on 30 years with Little. Do you have any advice for professionals staying within one firm rather than shifting? Because it sounds like you've had a number of different roles and shifts and change of location along your journey.
I did early on. And maybe that's part of it. Again, I think it depends on what you're looking for. And I always say the most important thing about adulting is really understanding what you want. What do you really want? What do you want to do every day? It's not your position is not your title. Your role is what you're doing. So like when people say, I want to be in leadership, it's kind of like, well, what do you like? What do you think you like about leadership? What is it you want to do? If you want the title, that's very different from, you know, somebody who's dealing with conflict resolution. You know, I met with somebody years ago and they said, well, I feel like I need to be a studio principal. That's the next step in my journey. And I asked that question. They said, well, I just feel like I've done this long enough that I should be, that's the next step. And I was like, okay, let me step back. You hate interpersonal conflict. Because this person was a pleaser, amazing person, but it was kind of the worst possible place for them to be. There were other leadership roles, you know, where they would shine and that would play to their strengths. But it's the same sort of thing. I think you really have to look at what is it that you want? And are you getting that where you are or not? You know, and it could be, we have a lot of boomerangs too, a lot of people that leave and then maybe spend a couple years or, you know, maybe even shorter sometimes at another firm and then come back. But they've gone out and they've scratched that itch and they've looked for what they thought they wanted to find, you know, and then they've decided, yeah, it works for me or it doesn't work for me, you know, and there's no shame either way. For me, again, I remember the day that my husband was coming down the hallway in Charlotte when we were working in Charlotte and I was going the other way and he was like, I think I like it here. Like, I think this place is really good. I think I like the culture. And he was like, I might have ambition. I was like, imagine that. it was just a funny thing, you know, when you find the place where you fit, like when you were looking for a college or university and you were touring the campus, I remember saying, you know, somebody said to me, can you see yourself here? I think it's the same way for a firm. Can you see yourself there? Can you see lots of different opportunities for you there? Lots of different things for you to explore and understand and learn. Those are the things I think that should keep you there rather than the timing. I think there is some some truth to that. If you're looking, if someone's looking at your resume and you move every year or year and a half, they might think of that as an adverse thing, and they may or may not interview you. So maybe there's a period, you know, that it works, and then it, maybe if it's too short, that's not a great idea. But at least stay somewhere for 2 years, I'd say, before you jump somewhere else.
Yeah, especially get that project experience, because if everybody's been, as much as I talk to professionals outside the AAC industry that they do more hopping early in their career, they see things regularly month to month, whereas a project can take a while to actually see it from start to finish. And then if you hop, it's like, well, have you seen construction?
Right.
Have you seen the design process? Have you learned from the mistakes you've made along the way?
Definitely.
So, and having little actually fit for you and your husband, because it's not just about one person at that point. So is your husband still at little?
He is. He is. And his position's changed as well. So he was most recently a studio principal and is now one of the directors of what we call our Regen Collab, which deals with regenerative design and sustainability, as other people might know it, but taking it that step further.
Yeah. So it's always hard to find one that works for you, but to work for two people is always hard too.
Yeah. Kind of magical.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for professionals stepping into those leadership roles within the firm? I know you started to touch on it to find the right leadership role for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that understanding you got to that place by doing something really well. But most of the times when you're stepping into leadership, you're not going to be doing that thing that got you there all the time. And one of the biggest issues that I have a recurring conversation with people about is delegating, because I'm really good at this and that's what got me here. And I want to keep doing that. But if you keep doing that, then you're not doing your next role. And you're not going to know everything when you step into your next role. And your people that have put you in that role understand that. You know, you're going to learn your way along. They think highly of you, enough of you to have put you in that role. So that's also maybe a good question when you get the role, asking, what was it that you saw in me that you think helps identify me to be successful in this role? Sort of understand what they saw in you and understand the things that they think are important that you bring to the table. Those are important things to understand. But delegation is a huge one, because I think it's really hard for people to go, it's just easier if I do it myself, then explain to somebody else. Then you will be doing it yourself for the rest of your career, because no one will ever learn. And you're basically standing in the way of somebody else learning and their opportunities. You know, if you're constantly doing the thing and they're not allowed to do the thing, then they'll never get better and they'll never be able to advance and progress and step into leadership down the road as well. So it's a hard thing, but it's something you got to do. You know, you've got to sit down and explain it to someone and take a moment and breathe through it and trust somebody else. And it's never going to be done the way you would do it, or very rarely is it going to be done the way you do it. But that's okay. You're probably not doing it the way your predecessor did it either. There's a concept in the Army called the commander's intent. And the commander's intent was created so that in the heat of battle, when something goes wrong, and it always goes wrong, very much like the AC industry, it doesn't matter how you get there as long as you get there. So the commander says, take that hill. However you take that hill, you start with a plan, but as soon as something goes wrong, you know, you've got to regroup, you've got to be resourceful, you've got to keep your head about you, and then you've got to find a way to take that hill.
Yeah, and learning delegation can start so early in somebody's career, because I teach that to even young professionals that are 2 years into their career. Absolutely. I'm like, hey, the next generation's coming in. I need help. You've done these interior elevations and you can do them beautifully. I want you to go teach that person how to do it, and how you teach it's going to be different than how I taught you. And that's fine, as long as you know what the end result needs to get to, or if you need to see examples of what it needs to look like in the end.
Right.
How you get there, some ways are better than others, but that's where they're teaching moments. If everybody's going to draw on lines versus modeling, that would be something I would teach. But if it looks right in the end, the contractor can price it out just the same, even if you modeled it slightly different than I would have.
Yeah. And who knows, that person might bring something to it that's even better than you do, because than you would.
Exactly.
Because they have a different experience and a different way of looking at something. And that's those are valuable teaching moments for both sides, you know, of the equation.
Yeah, because you never know what they learn mm-hmm. along the way to be able to teach you either something updated. Or I remember I was doing something for years because I knew a program for a while. And then they're like, oh, do you know you can do this now? And I'm like, crap, I missed that. Because if you're on big projects, sometimes you miss an upgrade or two sure. and you skip a couple years. Sure. And then it's like, oh, well, that's dumb. I could have been doing that. Like, thank you for letting me know. But I also wanted to touch on, with the delegation side, also going from being very in the weeds on a project to stepping back to high level, because I feel like that's another transition moment as people get higher and higher
up. Big adjustment. Yeah, very much so. And my background was very much design when I first came out of undergraduate school, in that interstitial year between when I went to grad school. And so I started off really on the design side, more heavier design. So I tend to be a bigger picture person, probably less of a detail person in general. I like context rather than text. That is a big adjustment because most of us get into this because we love doing it. You know, when I was in school, this was my drafting program. It was all hand drafting, and it's lovely because it gives you time to think as you're pulling a line. And, you know, just the act of moving while you're thinking for me was really, I loved it. I mean, it was fabulous and addictive, and it was relaxing and exciting, everything all at once. So it is challenging for some people. Now, there are different levels of leadership, right? So if you're a studio principal, if you're working with a client every day, you're maybe not drafting every day. You might be drafting some, you might be reviewing, you're still going to be involved in big picture decisions as far as design or finishes or, you know, whatever those things might be, how spaces are sequenced or how, you know, the visioning happens. You might be the person leading the visioning, doing outreach and focus groups with the end users, you know, that kind of thing. So you're still having, I think, a direct contact with people, you know, that are outside your company. I think once you start getting into maybe more executive levels of leadership, that's when you start kind of getting more farther away from projects. And that can be difficult. Like there are times, though, when if you have a specialty, one of my specialties is well building design, and I love it. And I do visioning as well. So there are times when I'm asked to come in to do those things still. Not a lot, not as much as I used to. But when I get the opportunity to do it, I just, you know, you love it. It's just a lot of the reason why you get into design. But as you do engage in higher levels of leadership or more executive levels of leadership, your projects change, right? So they change from objects and buildings to people. Your projects are people, or your projects are structure. Your projects are strategic plans. Your projects are, how do we get from here to there? And where is there? And what is it? What's going to be there when we get there? Those kind of things. So there's still, I think, as long as you, or at least for me, as long as I'm still learning, as long as I'm still doing something that's different, I have a very short attention span, and I'm very curious by nature. So it's a lethal combination, but it works for me, and I enjoy it. You know, so it's constantly, you know, what's next? What's the next thing? And the responsibility that you feel, I think, when you step into an executive leadership position, is it's not just about me; it's about the 450 people that we're working with, you know, that are standing next to me. And I need to make sure that whatever I'm doing, I'm positioning their future to be successful and to be everything they want it to be. And that involves a lot of conversations with people and a lot of sort of looking at the market and looking at the culture that's out there and figuring out how that's going to affect the architecture and design industry.
Welcome back. And so I hope you guys enjoyed the entire firm series, as well as this particular episode on large firms. So if you need a recap, it was Ty Osbo. He was episode number 9, and he is at Gensler and focuses on airports and aviation design. Steve Lodge was episode number 49, and he is with Smith Group and is an architecture discipline principal. And finally, Carol Ricard-Bordeaux. And she was episode number 73, and she is now the CEO of Little. And so she's now been that for 2 or 3 years. I can't remember from the time of the recording. So I hope you guys enjoyed seeing the different avenues within the firm series on how being a principal in a firm is not as cut and dry as you think it might be. There are different roles and responsibilities depending on the size firm you're at, what you need to do day to day, and what your roles can be. So hopefully that helps you determine where you want to grow in your career and what type of principal you want to be in the future. So hopefully you guys enjoyed the firm series.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Learn some advice to take with you and see how our industry is all tied together to create the world around us. Check out the description below for any links or resources we discussed. If you liked the episode, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. Give me a thumbs up and leave a comment below. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support finding that career path that best works for them. If you know someone that has inspired your own career that you'd like me to interview, let me know in the comments below, or you can reach out to me via my website or LinkedIn. I'd be happy to share their story or your own. Thank you again, and I cannot wait for the next career story I get to share with you next week.